Welcome to WISA Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. Coming up on today's program, you'll meet a triathlete champion who is up for an Athlete of the Year award. You'll also hear how the living and the dead will celebrate at the annual Dia de los Muertos Festival in Dayton. And later in the program, Bill Felker has this week's Poor Will's Almanac. Up first, as Election Day nears, advocates continue to lobby for and against a ballot measure that would limit how much Ohio could pay for prescription drugs. After months of political ads on both sides, some voters are confused about how the passage of Issue 2 could affect them. For more details about the proposal, we sat down with Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau's Andy Chow. Chow says if passed, Issue 2 would tie the cost of prescription drugs purchased by state agencies to the price paid by the Veterans Administration.
The proponents of this issue say that they want the state to get that same discount for the medications that they buy through their programs.
Perhaps somewhat ironically, Veterans Affairs are not behind this.
Yeah, because the whole deal here is, will forcing the state to buy drugs at a discounted price, is that actually going to lead to lower drug prices? So you got to take, for example, one thing is Medicaid. Medicaid already buys drugs at some type of discount, and they already negotiate with drug companies what kind of discount that'll be. So forcing the state to have a discount in place already, former Medicaid directors in the state says that that'll handicap their negotiations and take away some of their leverage in their negotiations to say that, well, they already have to buy at a certain discounted price. The other side of this is also, if the state is buying drugs at a discounted price, opponents of this issue say that'll force the drug companies to raise the prices of their drugs for people who get their health care coverage from something other than a state program. So if you're getting health insurance through private insurance, if you're getting it through your employer, opponents of this say that the prices you pay for your drugs are going to go up because of the discounted price on the state side, because of the discounted price that's created through Issue 2. Now, again, as we see with any sort of political issue, even though the side that opposes this issue says that it'll send up the prices of drugs, the people who are for this issue say that that is not going to happen, that if you vote yes on Issue 2, then it'll force the state to buy drugs at a lower cost, and then that drug company will still offer drugs at a lower cost for other programs as well.
Is there a state version of the Congressional Budget Office that has weighed in on this?
Yep, so there is a state agency that has weighed in on this. It's the Office of Budget and Management. This is the office that takes a look at all sorts of budget issues and helps the governor and the legislature figure out their budget as well. And they said there's no way of knowing whether this issue is going to help lower drug costs or not. I think the thing is that there's just no way of knowing because we don't know how the market will work. We don't know how those negotiations will go. And so it's hard to say if the people who are for this issue, the yes on Issue 2 people, there's no way of knowing if their claim that this can save the state and the save taxpayers $400 million, there's no way of knowing if that's actually going to happen.
Can you give us an idea of or a summary of who is behind this issue urging voters to vote yes?
That is a tougher question because, so yes, there is this group, the AIDS Healthcare Foundation, based out of California. Their founder, Michael Weinstein, he's the one who tried to get this passed in California. It did not pass in California. They are now here in Ohio trying to pass it. They say that they are against big drug companies that inflate their prices, that they say gouge people's pocketbooks with these high-priced drugs. They say that they are here to bring the cost of drugs down. That's the side that's for Issue 2. Now, the side against Issue 2, it's a group called the Ohioans Against the Deceptive Prescription Ballot Issue. Now, what we do know is that is well-funded by the pharmaceutical industry, by the pharma lobbying group. What we don't know is exactly which drug companies are throwing in the big bucks because of some pass-through entities and through an LLC, we're not able to find out and pinpoint exactly which drug companies are putting out the big money. But I think it's fair to say that it is from a lot of the bigger drug companies who don't want to see this issue pass in Ohio.
Andy Chow with the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Thanks for your time today and some clarity on this issue.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Last week, workers at Fuyao Glass America in Moraine filed for representation with the United Auto Workers Union. To learn more about the process of forming a union and what to expect with next month's Fuyao union vote, WISO's April Leslie spoke with a labor relations expert. Matt Crawford is an attorney with the firm Dahl, Jensen & Ford. It's a Dayton practice that represents the interests of workers and unions. The firm is not involved in the Fuyao union effort.
What are some of the advantages to unionization for employees?
One of the main reasons to join a union is to secure a collective bargaining agreement. And what that collective bargaining agreement secures is oftentimes just cause for discipline, so there aren't arbitrary management decisions in terms of issuing discipline. It secures wages and benefits for the workers there. It also provides workplace democracy. You, as an employee in a union, are allowed to directly elect your representation within that union. That's a voice that you don't have on the job without a union in place. So it's all of those things that are some of the main reasons for moving forward with union representation.
And what steps do workers typically take to get ready to file?
What happens is a group of employees will get together and basically sign cards indicating that they're interested in union representation. Once there is a sufficient number of those cards, a showing of interest is actually what it's called. At that point in time, then either the union or the organization seeking to represent those workers will file for a petition with the National Labor Relations Board in Cincinnati.
Okay. And in this case, that organization is the UAW.
That's right. That's right.
And you mentioned the showing of interest. How many or what percentage of employees have to be interested in joining a union before they can move forward?
Sure. The showing of interest has to be 30% of employees in the petition for bargaining unit. Oftentimes, a union will want to go above and beyond that 30%. It could be as high as 50 or 60% or even higher.
Okay, so it's typically more than a majority even before they head out to vote. Now, we've learned recently that the election dates have been set for November 8th and 9th. Obviously, there's going to be a lot going on between now and then. Can you give us just a quick rundown of what we can expect to happen?
Well, between now and the time of the election, basically the management side as well as the union will attempt to make their respective arguments as to why they should or should not vote for representation. The management side has a lot more time with employees. They basically can reach their employees anytime during the workday. So they typically will engage in what are called captive audience meetings, where employees are brought in to listen to either a presentation or a video to explain, you know, why they should not be voting for union representation. The union is more limited. They don't have necessarily that direct access to employees. They can't order them to attend a meeting with management representatives to listen to their side of things. But what the employer will have to do is provide a list of eligible voters in the election. And that's the way that the union will reach out to those people.
All right. So can you explain what the election process is like? What's the day like? And how soon will we know what the results are?
Sure. Basically, the employees will show up. They will cast their ballot in person. There will be observers available. Typically, the employer as well as the union can establish observers to just verify the tally of ballots, which usually takes place within, I would say, a couple days after the election.
Let's say that Fuyao employees do vote to unionize. What are the next steps after that?
Well, the next steps after that include the board, the National Labor Relations Board, certifying those results of the elections. The UAW would become the certified representative of that union, and then they would begin negotiating with the employer for a first collective bargaining agreement.
Okay, on the other hand, let's say they don't vote to unionize. What happens then?
There is the potential to file another petition in the future. Depending on sort of how the vote were to shake out, there may be the potential for filing objections to the election and having basically a hearing officer determine whether the vote was improperly influenced, and that can be done through objections or through an unfair labor practice charge.
Okay, so let's step back to the petition and election process again. It seems like it really hasn't taken all that long for things to start moving here. The workers originally filed their petition back on October 17th, I believe, and the election is scheduled for early November. Is that fairly typical?
The process is more streamlined than it used to be. There was an election rule that took effect in 2015 that really modernized a lot of how the board conducts their elections. The process is generally taking a little bit less time than it used to from the time of the filing of the petition to the actual election.
WISO's April Leslie with labor relations expert Matt Crawford. You're listening to WISO Weekend on 91.3 WISO. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for joining us. Grace Norman is a sophomore at Cedarville University. She's also the reigning Paralympic gold medalist in her class, winning at the 2016 Rio de Janeiro Games. And it's been a busy 2017 for the young athlete. In March, she defended her PT5 class championship at the Sarasota Paratriathlon American Championships. And in July, she took first place in her class at the ITU Paratriathlon Championship in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. The 19-year-old nursing major is now one of five women across the country nominated for the Team USA Female Paralympic Athlete of the Year. We spoke to her this week on the Cedarville campus about her accomplishments and what she wants for herself after college.
My name is Grace Norman. I am 19 years old. I am a sophomore at Cedarville University. I'm studying nursing. I was born without my left foot due to a congenital condition called amniotic bands. And I run cross country and track for Cedarville. And I also am a Paralympic gold medalist and bronze medalist in the triathlon and 400 respectively. So I've been in athletics ever since I was a little girl.
Talk about your interest in nursing briefly. Tell us where that started.
Yeah, so my mom is a doctor and my sister is now a registered nurse. And both of them have had a lot of influence in my life, and I also have a big heart to help people, and so I thought nursing would be a perfect fit for me. I'm now in my second year, and I'm definitely loving it, and it's confirming more this is where I need to be.
And so let's talk about your love of athletics as well.
Yeah, so I started with an early age in athletics. I started with T-ball, and then went to soccer and basketball, and then in high school I started running and cross country and track, and then I also swam in high school as well, and then I got into triathlon because of my dad. He started doing triathlons, and I thought it'd be a cool challenge, and I loved the swimming and running aspect of it, and then I was like, I'm sure I can bike. And so that started when I was about 14, and then has just blossomed into a pretty incredible career.
You mentioned the challenges you were born with actually have maybe helped you excel in athletics.
Yeah, I think definitely having a disability, quote unquote, from birth is definitely a way for me to become very comfortable with myself. And it also gives me different challenges to push through as a child and learn a lot of dedication and hard work in just everyday life and in athletics. And so I think it's definitely instilled in me a very competitive spirit and a very hard work ethic.
And let me ask, what kind of assistive technology do you use in your daily life and athletics?
In daily life, I just use a normal walking prosthetic. And in running, I use a cheetah foot, like the J-leg, made from carbon fiber. And biking, I use a very similar prosthetic to the one I walk in. It's just made out of carbon fiber and aligned a bit differently. And then I don't swim with any other, like any assistive device or prosthetic.
Throughout your life, have you noticed people's perception of you change as you participate and even excel in athletics?
I think when people don't know me originally and they see me at like the starting line or, you know, at a swim meet or something, and they see that I have a prosthetic, I think their perception of me is a bit different than what it should be. I think they think I am slow. I'm just, you know, out there and like, oh, there, you know, like the pity clap, you know, like she's going to be slow. She's, good try. But once they see me compete and actually start excelling, and then I think their perception changes a bit to, wow, like you're inspiring. You're a very strong athlete. And like, I respect you for your hard work. And so I think it does change.
So you're one of five women nominated for USA Female Paralympic Athlete of the Year, and There's a vote going on right now, right?
Yeah, there is. The vote opened about a week ago, and it goes through, I believe, Monday. So, yeah, it's a huge honor to be nominated against these other four women, and I'm very excited to see the results.
Do you know much about who you're up against?
I do, yeah. I've been up against these some of these women a few different times or different awards. They're all very accomplished and all well-deserving.
Are they national or local women?
National. I don't believe are from Ohio, but I see them in one of them I compete with in track. She was on the Paralympic track team with me, so that was really cool. It's cool to see her nominated as well.
You're our local girl, so let's tell folks how they can help you.
Yeah, so just go on Team USA, I think it's /awards.org, and you can vote for me as many times as you want through Monday, and that would be really helpful.
Well, great. Let's talk about what you want to do after college here at Cedarville.
Yeah, after college, I look to become a registered nurse and work hopefully in the ER or trauma care, and looking to go professional in triathlon and pick up some sponsors and compete professionally for the United States and hopefully go to the Paralympics another like 4 or 5 times.
I bet your parents are so proud.
Yeah, my parents are very proud and very supportive of all my efforts. They love going to my competitions, whether it's college or the international competitions. They always want to be there, even if it's like a plane flight or a very long drive. They love it.
Oh, that's great. Grace, thanks so much for speaking with us, and good luck with everything.
Thank you so much.
Grace Norman is a sophomore at Cedarville University. She's also one of 5 women across the country nominated for the Team USA Female Paralympic Athlete of the Year. Voters have until Monday, October 30th, to register their choice at the awards at awards.teamusa.org/vote. Dayton's Dia de los Muertos celebration is today. It's the Day of the Dead, a Mexican holiday that has its roots in Aztec rituals that honored the dead. Today, it's celebrated in countries around the globe. Here in Dayton, there's a parade, Mexican songs and dancing, and lots of altars designed to lead the spirits of lost loved ones back home. Community Voices producer Jason Reynolds says it promises to be a good time for both the dead and the living.
That's a brass band playing in Dayton's Day of the Dead parade a few years ago. They were followed by dancing skeletons and women in beautiful Mexican dresses who had their faces painted to look like detailed decorative skulls. Every year, the parade works its way to the Missing Piece Art Space, a gallery in St. Anne's Hill that displays dozens of altars made by community members. Gabriela Pickett owns the gallery. She was born in Mexico and grew up with the holiday. But when a local artist approached her about celebrating in Dayton, she wasn't quite sure.
I was a little bit skeptical at the beginning because I thought, well, you know, there's really not a lot of Hispanics that celebrate Day of the Dead in Dayton, so who's going to go? And 300 people showed up, so we were quite surprised. Not a lot of them were Hispanic, you know, which actually makes it really beautiful. You know, this is a Mexican tradition that brings the community together.
To celebrate the Day of the Dead, people make altars, or ofrendas, that are designed for departed loved ones. Pickett made one for her father this year. It's a small model of a Mexican home with a tile roof. It's made of and filled with his favorite things.
Yeah, my dad was an architect, and he made houses made out of adobe and the traditional, you know, the Spanish tiles. He was a violin player, so he had 2 violins and, you know, music because he liked to play Vivaldi. He was an artist, so, you know, there's pencils for him to draw. You know, this is the food that he liked to eat.
M.B. Hopkins is the local artist who approached Gabriela Pickett about starting a Dayton Day of the Dead. This year, Hopkins made an altar inside of a cigar box. There are 3 shiny skeletons, one playing a guitar, one smoking a cigarette. Those 2 are human. There's also the skeleton of a cat.
This is an altar for my mother and father, who both passed away. My dad was a guitar player, you know, and so he's depicted here as a skeleton holding his guitar. My mother was a chain smoker, it's not the best habit, and maybe that lent her demise. But, you know, there's the little cat that was hers, who's also passed away.
The top of the box has her parents' names on it. They went by Patty and Hop.
They were married for, you know, dozens and dozens of years. And in fact, my father died before my mother. And when my mother was in hospice, one of the last things she said was, "Hop, Hop," as if she could see him, you know, and then she stopped breathing and died.
And there's not just art for the dead. Sometimes there's art made with the dead, literally. Local artist Tiffany Clark is best known for the murals she's painted on buildings in the Miami Valley. When the man she described as her soulmate passed away, she ended up using his cremains in a painting that was displayed for the Day of the Dead.
He had always wanted his ashes made into artwork so he could last forever, because he was a bit of a, he liked himself. So it took me a while to figure out what kind of artwork or to actually make myself do it. And I made him into a beautiful oil painting that was a rhino from an unusual perspective with teals and different circles that resembled similar artwork that he had made. And it was just this sense of not closure but continuation, that I could share him forever with people, because honestly I was not okay until I figured out a way to connect with him in a positive way, and this is my positive way.
And the Day of the Dead is meant to be a celebration of life and an opportunity to honor our ancestors. One of the original ideas of the holiday is that if a dead person came back, they would be offended to see us mourning. They'd much prefer a party. And a mariachi band wouldn't hurt. For Culture Couch at WYSO, I'm Jason Reynolds.
Today's Day of the Dead festivities start off at the Old Yellow Cab building at 2 o'clock. There will be food trucks and face painting, followed by a parade to the Missing Piece Art Space, where guests can watch performances and view ofrendas. To see the art mentioned in this story, visit WYSO.org. Culture Couch is made possible by a generous grant from the Ohio Arts Council. I'm Jerry Kenny. You're listening to WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. Thanks so much for joining us. On November 4th, Indian Mound Reserve in Cedarville will host an Underground Railroad tour where visitors will hike and play the parts of fugitive slaves on their journey. Naturalist Melissa Grosvenor will portray Sadie, a guide on the Underground Railroad, who will explain the role lanterns played in the journey. And for more details, we paid a visit to the Narrows Reserve in Beaver Creek to talk to Grosvenor, who tells us that the interactive tour will also reveal what role Greene County played in the Underground Railroad. Mel, you've got a terrific event coming up November 4th that will actually let people really engage with history. It's a tour of the Underground Railroad at Indian Reserve.
Yes, Indian Mound Reserve is just outside of Cedarville off of 42, and we have good reason to believe that the Underground Railroad actually passed through that park. It has some really cool natural features like rocky cliffs and things like that, and it follows a river, and that would have been a natural path for the slaves. But we do know that that area was populated by a lot of folks who came up from the South because they were against slavery. So there were some ministers that brought up their congregations. Also, Wilberforce University, which is still, you know, in existence today, was an African-American college, the very first owned by African-Americans in the whole country. So there's lots of folks in that area that definitely would have helped any slaves that were coming through.
So you mentioned that it was a likely path along the Underground Railroad.
Well, we know that 42, as it passed through that area, was actually called Columbus Pike back in the day. And following the rivers and going along ridges and stony outcrops, that would have been maybe a little safer than just traveling on the road where you'd be a little bit more exposed. And we do know that there were several stops in the area. There were at least 7 stations in Wilberforce. Locally in Greene County, there were at least 31 people that are known to have helped on the Underground Railroad. 19 of them were black and 12 were white. A lot of times people think of the abolitionists and conductors as all being white, but there are actually a lot of blacks who helped out as well.
So this is an exciting chance for people to walk along the path. Tell us what's going to take place on November 4th. You're going to be doing a bit of theater?
Yeah, it's not just a program where you come and, you know, hear a presentation or see someone in costume acting as first person, you actually get to engage and become part of this. It's like a play. The participants are going to portray slaves, and they will be going out after dark by lantern light through the woods. So just that in itself is kind of an adventure, but you'll meet characters along the way that will help you along the Underground Railroad and kind of teach you a little bit of the history of it in Greene County as you go.
I just talked to someone this morning when I told them what I was going to do with this interview, and they said they actually went through a similar program in school, and it has stayed with them their whole lives.
Yeah, that may have been. I actually have a little bit of background. I worked at a place called Camp Joy, and I know they, to this day, do that very program, and I fell in love with it. I thought that was a neat thing and kind of brought a similar experience, although different. This one is focusing more on Greene County and how it, you know, really was central in this area. There were four routes that went through Greene County alone, and so it kind of brings it closer to residents in this particular area.
Tell us how people can get involved. Is there a registration process?
Yes, you can get registration information and actually register online on our website, gcparkstrails.com. We are allowing children this time. We have done a similar program in the past and made it just adults. And when I worked at Camp Joy, we were doing this with fifth graders. And I thought, you know, kids, they would get as much out of this, and it's important for them as well. So if you are fifth grade or older, you are welcome to join us. We think it's a little too intense for anyone younger than that.
Mel Grosvenor with Greene County Parks and Trails, thanks so much, and good luck with the event.
Oh, you're welcome. We're really excited about it. This is going to be a lot of fun.
This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac for the third week of middle fall and the first week of the apple cider moon. Early in the afternoon of the recent solar eclipse, I was cutting back zinnias in my garden. Sparrows chirped on and off, and cicadas buzzed, and cardinals and crows called once in a while. A friend had phoned me the day before, and he said that he had heard that birds stopped singing in the middle of a solar eclipse, as though they thought maybe night had arrived. Well, as the eclipse progressed, the dense honeysuckles and the high locusts that surrounded my yard took on an amber glow. It was not a vision of October so much as a transfiguration of summer to a thin, burnished time far from the decay of autumn. Then I noticed the cicadas were quiet, and I didn't hear any birds. A little later, as the filter of the eclipse was weakening, two monarch butterflies suddenly appeared from over the trees, and they soared majestically into the yard and floated down beside me. Then one of the monarchs rose high, then swooped toward the other as though he could not hold back, and his consort rose steeply to meet him, and they spun in rapturous encounter, swirling up and around and across the flowers in tight randori. The sun came out from behind the moon, and the monarchs flew south over the house together, and everything became the way it once had been. Cicadas buzzed again, sparrows chirped, a cardinal sang. Toward the west end of town, crows called out. This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the final week of middle fall. In the meantime, listen for the birds and watch for the last butterfly. They're all gifts of time. Poor Will's Almanac for 2018 is now available. Order yours from Amazon, or for an autographed copy, order from poorwillsalmanac.com. That's Almanac with a K.
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide, including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs. Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at wyso.org.
That's it for this edition of WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world. I'm Jerry Kenny. We'll be back next Sunday morning at 10. Coming up next on WISO, it's Vic McCunis with the Book Nook.